Is it, do you think, also present even in mythological, in the undifferentiated mythological man?
I doubt it, except that you have also in early cosmological civilizations like the Egyptians, the same type of crisis that we have. Mm. And you get then, already in the third millennium, a crisis literature, skepticism, and elaborate literary documents expressing alienation. Mm-hmm. And this alienation analysis is couched already in the same symbols in which all alienation symbols reappear later. We live in a world as in a prison, as in a hospital from which we have to get out, in death from which we have to go into life. All of these things in the Egyptian case, I'm referring to the dialogue of suicide, which is so to be solved by suicide, because other possibilities like Christianity were not there yet.
You have an extraordinarily early one. I don't know whether you're familiar with it. Of the Sumerian, what shall I do today?
Yeah. That is a bit later. It's about the same time. Same time also, third millennium.
And the slave answering him, they consider it to be the fly that the master wants.
Yeah.
And the master turns and he takes.
Yeah.
I will have women today.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, yes. Of course, have all the beautiful girls in there. And then he says, but I will not have no one. They are a cause of destruction and dissension and disappointment. And it finally ends up, what then is happening? And the slave turns around and says, to break my neck and then break thine. That is how.
So you have this alienation literature, you have it, your analysis of the situation. But the solution to construct a system in that situation was not found yet.
I want to go over to the more artistic table, just in that sense of, you mentioned the Kafka, Henry James, I think you mentioned also Beckett.
Yeah.
Could you just say a word or two about those as explicitating, you mentioned that Henry James wasn't the clearest example of this, of someone who's explicitating an alienation, but obviously Beckett is an extremely clear one.
Well, he did it from a much lower level of intellectual technical perfection. He, after all, was a competent philosopher, knew his business, and he could think through a problem, even if he perverted it to perfection, you see, in the perversion, you see, which was beyond the range of men like Henry James or Kafka. They just didn't have the philosophical competence to pervert the problem completely. They had to be satisfied.
Were they better off
as a result
of that today?
I don't think they were better off. No. But that is the reason why men like he are the most instructive. Because there you can catch them up. They know what they are doing. But men like Henry James and Kafka never quite know what they are doing.
And you use the phrase
very
quite a few times, the divine ground of existence. I'm just wondering, if Klaus were to meet an analytic philosopher, a typically analytic philosopher,
Political analysis.
It strikes me as the type of phrase they would immediately take exception to as being at least vague and incoherent. I wonder if you ever had a discussion or anything with these types.
That requires technical elaboration. Symbols like the protearchy, this would be the divine ground, is not vague at all. It means quite precisely the divine pole of the tension. But that is it. And there's nothing vague about it. The definition as one pole of attention. The one is the human pole, the other is the divine pole. How the divine pole then will reveal itself in a particular experience, that is another matter, which one can never predict, because after all, there you get the divine reality, which seems on some occasions to prefer to reveal itself in one way, and on other occasions in another way. But the protearchy is a perfectly exact concept. It isn't vague. Only it had to be found gradually. You see, for instance, the term tension, which I use, is not to be found in classic philosophy. The term tension, tasis, appears for the first time after Aristotle and with the Stoics.
You think it's not at all in Aristotle?
No, it isn't there. It's a dictionary question. It isn't there. But only the concrete aspects of tension. You get terms like eros, like philia, like elpis, like pistis, that you get. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the term tension as an abstract, comprising all of these concrete aspects of tension, is not used yet.
Say
it was
like the rule of what
Stoics
and why did they use it?
I've forgotten that the moment you find it in Cellar, the footnote is there, or in the Arnim edition of the Stoics under Tarsis, you can find it in the index.
So, curious enough, one of the categories, another type of philosopher, is the the man who will use philosophy to make suffering bearable, probably of the tensions between his existential situation, what he knows to be the case, which would bring about the state of pathological tension were he not to philosophize.
Yeah.
That distinction that you mentioned there strikes me as being very similar to Strawton's distinction between revisionary and descriptive metaphysics. In other words, he says that the revisionary metaphysician is one who seeks to change our view of the world in some way or other. Descriptive metaphysician is one who just seeks to articulate the common experience of mankind.
Yes, so the difference here would be that there's a pathology.
Yes.
And not, again, fall back on your reassurance, not a medical pathology,
yes.
But a cultural pathology.
Well, I don't know whether it's cultural. It can be caused by a cultural situation. That a man is not spiritually energetic enough to cope with a situation in which one could feel alienated. He succumbs to alienation.
The other thing Gilbert Murray describes in Five Stages of Religion as the failure of nerve, which surely is a pathological collapse of a collective consciousness, the collapse of a collective expectancy, where you get a withdrawal. The first symptoms, which I think is Socrates himself, where you get a withdrawal into interiority, in order to make the world bearable.
Well, that is a great question. See, I'm not sure about that. We don't know. Because there are cultural situations where, through participation in a certain degree of corruption, you do not achieve anything except your own corruption. And that is a point where in what you call interiorization may become a duty. That would not be a failure of nerve, but an understanding of the true situation. You don't get anywhere by playing the game. Except these two.
I was testing recorded.
You
have an attention. Good. Yes, this is tremendously important. This is tremendously important.
That was Plato's reason why he did not go into politics. Yes. Socrates' fate once, if you do it a second time, you make yourself ridiculous.
Yes. Aristotle says this, I must leave Athens because the crime against philosophy must not be committed again. This is the resignation syndrome.
How would you feel about that in the context, we'd say, of the German universities in times of Nazi times? Would you say that then the academic, the man who presumably had the means and the leisure to analyze the situation, by remaining, he couldn't help but be corrupted. I just put to you the question. Do you feel that this is what happened?
This would actually happen.
Do you think that a man like Bonhoeffer
is perhaps not the best case? You see, Bonhoeffer has become very famous because he got killed. But that doesn't elevate him to the rank of a first-rate thinker. And I'm skeptical a bit about Bonnet. But there are other people who were better.
Yes. But would you share a certain suspicion that I have of people who would only read masterpieces?
Yeah.
Well, and who won't read minor poets. It's not a criticism to say that he was not a frustrated thinker. He could have been a frustrated man.
Somehow you must see where the first rate is. When there, for instance, out of that whole mess have come a number of first-rate novelists. Some of them Austrians, like Broch, The Death of Virgil.